Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Egyptian turmoil blankets the news this week, and back home, a big blanket of snow in America. Egyptian protesters bloodied and still standing in days of street battle. They said they weren't backing down. The stakes are too big.
I got two daughters, and all these people are here, sacrificing all their for the benefit of these people, for the benefit of this country.
The United States now pushing for change. Here's Hillary Clinton yesterday.
I urge the government and a broad and credible representation of Egypt's opposition, civil society, and political factions to begin immediately serious negotiations on a peaceful and orderly transition.
And a winter hurricane swamped Lakeshore Drive in Chicago and much of the country. Here's one Chicago motorist on YouTube.
So it's been 10 hours since I've been stuck out here. And literally the snow is right at the top of the door, it's near the window.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times, Tom Jelton, NPR correspondent covering global security and economics, and our own Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What are we witnessing this week in Egypt? What do you make of Washington's response? And what's up with this weather? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. It's great to have all three of you with us. David Sanger right here with me in the studio. Let's hear the sound of the street a little bit in Cairo today. Here's CNN's Ivan Watson reporting on a quieter Cairo today, Friday, after a week of violence and confrontation.
The opposition has been able to successfully and peacefully congregate here by the thousands and kneel in the square behind me and conduct their prayers. And immediately afterwards, the crowd began chanting, "The blood of the martyrs will not be forgotten." And then they started, "He leaves, we don't leave," chanting that.
He leaves, we don't leave, but it is a quieter day. We talked yesterday with New York Times' Nick Kristof in Cairo. Here he is with some tape standing in Tahrir Square asking Dr. Nawal al-Sadawi, a famous activist for women's rights in the Arab world, why she had shown up at Liberation Square.
I am here because I feel I am born again. It's a very spontaneous revolution, not related to the left or the right or the Muslim brothers or anybody. If you see, they are ordinary people, ordinary young students, women and men who never know politics. So this is a real revolution.
There she is, feeling born again, and a little tape from the palace where Hosni Mubarak himself remains. ABC's Christiane Amanpour made her way into the palace yesterday, about 8 miles from the center of the protest. She spoke with Mubarak and Egyptian vice president, newly named Omar Suleiman. He told her he would not remove the young protesters from Tahrir Square, though he would ask them, he said, to go home. She asked Suleiman if the protesters have legitimate grievances.
We, of course, looked at their demands, and we discussed it here in this palace, and we decided that we have to respond positively. It is a process, starting by national dialogue, which I started this morning, and we will continue tomorrow and after tomorrow.
But for how long? With what outcome exactly? Tom Jelton, Jack Beatty, David Sanger, what a picture this week. David Sanger, what's the latest you're seeing from Cairo?
Well, the latest I read from our own correspondents on the ground there is that this is a much more peaceful day, and it is totally remarkable that the Egyptian authorities can turn on and off the thugs. It's kind of like a rent-a-thug operation. Yesterday they were engaged. Today they stayed away.
Huge crowd still in the square, but mainly protesters against Mubarak.
That's right. It seems. But you know, the thing that I thought was most remarkable today, and the biggest change to my mind, Tom, is that what you're seeing now is members of the Egyptian elite come into the square and try to identify themselves in some way with the protesters. So Yesterday and this morning, you've seen the head of the army, Field Marshal Tantawi, show up there. He was cheered by the protesters. And then you've seen Amr Moussa, who's the Secretary General of the Arab League. But he was, in a past life, the foreign minister under President Mubarak. And he came in and also appeared in the crowd and seemed to align himself with the protest as well. And I think in some ways that's got to be the most worrisome thing to the Mubarak regime, that they're beginning to lose some of their old loyalists.
Tom Gelton, you're watching all of this from Washington. How is Washington aligned right now? It would seem that they are putting direct pressure on President Mubarak to take off, to leave. What's the Washington position now, Tom?
Well, Tom, it seems to me that the Obama administration is really siding with this group that David Sanger characterizes as the elite, as opposed to sort of a rougher, more populist, more democratic constituency of the people in the square. From the beginning of this crisis, and especially last weekend, the Obama administration has been reaching out to people like Field Marshal Tantawi, the defense minister, like Omar Suleiman, another general who is now the vice president, and really, it seems to me, looking to the Egyptian army as the stabilizing, moderating influence. You're right, breaking with Mubarak, putting a lot of pressure on Mubarak, but stopping short of really endorsing sort of an uncontrolled, more populist uprising, really putting faith in the Egyptian army to intervene here and to sort of nudge Mubarak off the stage.
Tom, you know this region. You followed. Everybody's been wrapped in this last week and a half, nearly 2 weeks now. Do you think that will be good enough to satisfy the complaint that has arisen in the streets of Cairo and many other cities and towns around Egypt? Is it enough to shift this from Mubarak to the next tier of his inner circle?
I think that is the critical question right now, Tom. It's, you know, and it depends, I think, from day to day. You look at the sort of the level of passion in the square on the part of the protesters. Clearly, that would not be enough to satisfy a great many of the protesters. I think the hope would be, from the standpoint of people like Suleiman and Tantawi, the hope would be that it satisfies enough of the crowd to really defuse the protest. Obviously, it's not going to satisfy the bulk of the crowd, but if you just sort of, if you satisfy enough to really take the energy and some of the deeper passions out of the crowd, that they may be thinking that may be enough to get through this.
Jack Beatty, we're a long way off here, but you've seen these crowds. You've heard their complaints. It's not as if they're new. Washington has been complaining about Mubarak for years, but they've been very intense in these last 11 days. If it's sort of shifted off to Mubarak's, you know, near inner circle, is that good enough to satisfy what you just heard the woman there describe as a revolution?
It doesn't sound like it. On the other hand, I think they have fatigue. That is, the establishment there has fatigue going for them. I mean, people can't keep this up. The economy is at a standstill already. They're, you know, $2 a day or something. It seems to be about the average wage. And so I just think they can, you know, wait till the crowd punches itself out. And Mr. Suleiman, you know, I understand why we're comfortable with him, but of course that really shouldn't matter so much. He seemed to have been involved, if not running, our rendition program, our torture for hire program through Egypt, and that I think accounts for why the administration was glad to see him elevated. But that can't be our criterion. Not now. Not after we have seen these people. Not after we have met people. People Nick Kristof has introduced us to, for example, Amir, a man in a double amputee in a wheelchair, wounded during one of these battles, and Nick found the courage to say, how can you come here as a double amputee? And he says, I still have my hands. God willing, I will keep fighting. That's what we're seeing there, and Egypt deserves a government that good.
Let's hear from our listeners. Mike in Brattleboro, Vermont. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm just kind of questioning why we have to keep on buying our way into the Middle East. It seems like the support, this military support that we give, $1.3 billion, is just going for canisters of tear gas and that kind of nonsense. Now, basically, we're buying our way in the Middle East to protect Israel, and this is kind of nonsense. We have supported Marcos. We've supported Sukarno. We have supported the Shah of Iran, and now with Mubarak, previously other crazy regimes. All we do is get ourselves deeper and deeper and deeper. And I don't know when the United States is going to learn their lesson.
Mike, we've got it. David Sanger, you know, status quo with another face here. Our caller Mike sees a familiar pattern. Does it really change here? Do we really walk away from the kind of government that we've had in Cairo under Mubarak? Same thing, different face at the top? Or do you see elements of a real change, something new here?
Well, obviously, it's too early to tell. This is a marathon, and we are caught up right now in just the opening parts of this race. But let's peel back what Mike's point is here. It is very possible, and I think it's probably the White House's aim here right now, to bring about the democratic change, or at least help facilitate the democratic change, without walking away from the military. What is that $1.3 billion buying? Well, one could argue that in the past it has bought us a huge amount of support from Mubarak. Right now, it may be buying some influence with military officers who are on the way to guiding this thing to a peaceful end.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Egypt, snow, and the Fed chairman's warning not to play around with the U.S. debt limit sound all this week, and those powerful images out of Egypt, Tahrir Square, Liberation Square. There are protesters right there today in Tahrir Square. Some of them still, well, many of them still very upset, even this upset with Hosni Mubarak.
He needs to be executed in this square. Because here, people have died here. He killed the people in this street. Do you understand? He has to go.
Quite true. People have died there. Where this ends, nobody knows at the moment. Lots of pressure to keep images of all this away from the world. The offices of Al Jazeera, reportedly, Al Jazeera saying they were invaded, sacked, and burned by a group of thugs. Hillary Clinton speaking out forcefully on that in a press conference yesterday, condemning violence against journalists, many Americans included, renewing her calls for the country's peaceful transition, whatever that exactly may mean, to democracy.
There is a clear responsibility by the Egyptian government, including the army, to protect those threatened and to hold accountable those responsible for these attacks. The Egyptian government must demonstrate its willingness to ensure journalists' ability to report on these events to the people of Egypt and to the world.
Let's go to Teak in Middlebury, Vermont. Teak, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what's on your mind? What do you know?
Hi, I was a Middlebury College student, just recently evacuated from Alexandria, Egypt.
Welcome home.
And thank you. And as this situation escalates, I think we just need to remember that Mubarak and Suleiman just cannot be trusted. They are full of contradictions. When we were there, everything that came out of his mouth couldn't be trusted. For example, he said that he turned phone service back on, which was great, but he wouldn't sell the phone credit that people need to make phone calls. And he just continues to just riot on the people. For example, he said he was going to ask the people to go home, but in truth, he set his national security forces on them. And they were the ones that started the so-called pro-Mubarak protest right now. And right now, Mubarak is getting everything he wants. He wanted this chaos. The more this chaos happens, the more the people are confused, the more they aren't sure what they want. But in all honesty, this violence will not end until Mubarak is out of office.
The more they may be exhausted, though, as this thing goes on. Tom Gelton, I mean, how do you sense Washington reading this? Is the revolution in the streets finished here? Is it now all about kind of a playing an exhausted crowd towards something not so different from the status quo? Or when Hillary Clinton and others say there have to be free and fair elections, could that be the real deal now? Washington has said again and again that they have not been anything like that under Mubarak.
I think today is a really important day, and it's a little bit hard to make sense of what's going on. The largest crowds to date, but entirely peaceful, and that would seem to be a victory for the opposition movement. The fact that they were able to withstand those terrible attacks from goons over the last couple of days, they did not back down. I think that Mubarak was perhaps hoping that as a result of those attacks, people would get tired and they would get scared and they would sort of slow down or stop coming to the square. In fact, we've seen just the opposite happen. Now, why the pro-Mubarak goon forces are not out there today, I think is a good question. I agree with what David said earlier on, that I think you have to assume that whether these guys are there or not is the result of some deliberate decision by somebody in the power structure whether to send them out or not. I think earlier in the week, we saw a clear strategy on the part of the regime, if perhaps even by Mubarak personally, to present this image of chaos and anarchy, thinking that that would sort of frighten the Egyptian people and allow him via the army to establish the idea that what we need now is stability, what we need is order, then Mubarak and his forces would appear as the stabilizing, securitizing force, and that that would strengthen his position. But now I think it's hard to say what's going to happen next. The people are still there. And I think the regime now is going to have to sort of look to plan B.
David Sanger, we're reading in your newspaper, the New York Times, that the Obama administration is pushing a proposal, at least to the people around Mubarak. I mean, he wouldn't talk with the president's personal envoy after one meeting. Frank Wisner came flying home. But they're talking about a transitional government, inviting members from a broad range of opposition groups, including the formerly banned Muslim Brotherhood, to start talking about opening up the electoral system there, bringing about elections, free and fair elections by September. Does that constitute an answer, a full answer to what's been asked for in the streets? Does it look durable? Does it look like the Mubarak crowd would bite on that or even resist that? And as our caller suggests, sort of rope-a-dope this on and on and on until we're really back to closer something near what Mubarak has governed over?
Well, I think rope-a-dope probably is their strategy. What the Times story suggested this morning is that one option that the administration is exploring, and one they seem to be discussing with the Egyptians with some intensity, is to have President Mubarak leave and have Vice President Sulaiman step in. Now, constitutionally, this has got a bit of a problem because the vice president does not succeed the president under the Egyptian system. It would, in fact, be the head of the parliament, and the head of the parliament right now is completely dominated by Mubarak's party.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little hard to figure out how they would do this in a legal fashion, how much the constitution applies in these cases in Egypt is a little bit hard to test under these. It does raise the question, though, could the administration be right in trusting Sulaiman as a transitional figure, or once in place, would he seem like the transition to himself? And then you would have to ask the question, if you've traded Mubarak for his intelligence chief, even somebody who the Americans, the Israelis, and others are very comfortable with and know well, is that real change?
Let's go to Dayton, Ohio, and John. John, you're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I just had three quick points that I'd like you to respond to, if you could.
Uh-huh.
The first is, I was kind of confused as to exactly if the people were revolting because of a number of different reasons, or was there one specific reason that just got all these people hot and bothered over there? Because I know they're dealing with a lot of corruption and things.
Mm-hmm.
But I've heard that you alluded to the fact earlier in your program that they're most of the population, I think it's nearly half of them, like a $2 a day salary.
Yes,
or
that's
whatever.
Right. Yeah.
And I've heard that the reason that, I'm not sure if this is true or not, that the reason that these people all of a sudden got up upset and started revolting was because they actually cut those rations. Their food, they had like what you know be equivalent to food stamps over here in America.
Food prices have been going up. There's no question about that in Egypt. So let's look at what's behind this. And Tom Gelton, let me come to you on this, because Americans may be watching this and saying, holy smokes, you know, that is some gigantic reaction. I mean, we've all heard the litany over the years, but maybe people are paying attention for the first time now. Corruption, oppression, prisons full of even very sort of high-placed opponents, and a lot of economic woe in Egypt.
Well, I think the last straw, in a sense, actually came a couple of months ago with the parliamentary elections. I mean, this was the elections were deeply, deeply marred by fraud. And so what you've got right now is a parliament that is widely seen as illegitimate in Egypt. And I think that for many people, that was it. That was when they really sort of lost faith in the ability to bring about change, you know, through elections. And they only seemed that there was one option, which was to take to the streets. Combine that with this deep and lingering sense of resentment over the massive amounts of corruption in the system that reach all the way down to the guy in the street. I mean, this is a problem that touches everybody. And then, of course, you've got what happened in Tunisia and the sense there that actually going into the streets can bring about change. You know, it's often said that revolutions are prompted not by despair, but by hope. And seeing what the people in Tunisia were able to achieve by going into the streets, against this background of frustration over the parliamentary elections and the deeper frustration over the economy and corruption and rising food prices. Now, there is a very, very strong system of food subsidies in Egypt, but that government there has its own fiscal problems, and it's been made clear that they're not going to be able to continue that subsidy program to the extent that it was. So it's, I think, a combination of all those things.
Jack, how are you reading the Obama administration in the midst of this? There was a big uproar in Tahrir Square early on when Hillary Clinton described the Mubarak regime as stable, which people saw as a kind of endorsement of the status quo. Since then, all kinds of readings on exactly what President Obama himself and those around him may want here from the actions and statements that we're seeing. How do you read this? Is it real politic, like steady as she goes, let's not rock the boat too much? Is it some kind of emerging commitment to an era of change in this country, in this region? Just pragmatism? What do you see, Jack?
I think the latter. The president, the administration is trying to catch up with the crowds and yet not be ahead of them, perhaps be a step or two behind, as has been suggested by, you know, endorsing the vice president and this transitional regime. You know, last summer, I mean, Mike called earlier and said, how is it we support these dictators? Why? What have we got out of this policy? Well, the press this week had two answers. One is that of the $60 billion in aid that we've given him over the years, about $34 billion has come back to us, to our arms manufacturers. Effectively, this is an American jobs program off their dictatorship. Second, when we tried to raise the issue of elections and human rights there, look what's happened. Over the summer, John McCain and Russ Feingold got together with a resolution that called on the Egyptian president to have free and fair elections. What happened to it? Well, holds by two senators killed it. One was from Dianne Feinstein of California. She said it would hurt U.S. Egyptian cooperation on a range of issues. And the other by Roger Wicker of Mississippi. What was his reason? His friend, Bob Livingston, the former House Speaker and major lobbyist for the Egyptian government, called him up and said, can you really kill this? So they did. I mean, that's the kind of, you know, big picture jobs and little picture lobbying that have just palsied any effort of this government to hold Egypt accountable.
But surely that's a second-tier issue. Let's test that. Larry in Stanford, Connecticut. Larry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to hear more discussion of what follows from what I believe Secretary Clinton called for when she asked for an orderly and peaceful transition to real democracy. I understand that ever since Mubarak has been in power, he's been governing under emergency rule. And what I was wondering is, what would happen if that was lifted? and they return to ordinary rule in Egypt, and then whether the constitution of Egypt is in ways fatally flawed, and having real democracy would require a new constitutional convention and a new constitution and a new ratification process.
Larry, let us pick it up. It's true that Egypt has been governed under emergency rule ever since the assassination, or just after, of Anwar Sadat. We're talking decades ago now. That's what a lot of Egyptians have been protesting. And I should say, while we're speaking here, there have been cheers going up in Tahrir Square. Al Jazeera was reporting that these were because of rumors that Mubarak had resigned. We're reading now here from CNN. The people are cheering because of an announcement on state television Friday that the public prosecutor had frozen the assets of the country's trade minister and imposed a travel ban on him. If there's a target for corruption, perhaps that's one. David Sanger, speak to this. Hillary Clinton speaks of transition to democracy. Of course, that can mean a lot of things. It could mean something radical. It could mean something very modest. And, you know, the caller asks, does Egypt have to remake itself in order, after 30 years of emergency rule, to even to realize something, anything like that?
I think your caller is exactly right. Egypt would have to remake itself, and that remaking requires a few things. Certainly, it would require some constitutional changes, and this emergency rule that has been in place for 30 years, the entire time of the rule of Hosni Mubarak, is one thing that would certainly have to go out the door at some point if you were going to have a real democracy. But there's something else which I think helps explain the reticence of the Obama administration to leap in with both feet on the side of the protesters. And that is that what the administration fears the most here is a vacuum that could get exploited by either the Muslim Brotherhood or other Islamist groups that would give Iran or other countries a moment to go interfere. And remember, we've been through transitions from dictatorial regimes before, and the results have been very mixed, Tom. I mean, from our Asia days, you and I remember the Philippines and South Korea, two that worked out pretty well. Messy democracy.
Absolutely.
In the Philippines. South Korea, perhaps the closest example here, where you had a country run by a bunch of authoritarian generals gradually move to an electoral system where first the generals got elected and then civilians did.
Yes.
Okay?
But it's not a simple transition.
It was a long-term transition. Now, what's at the other end of this? Iran. Okay, and why has the Iranian government been out cheering this protest in the street?
And describing it as an Islamist uprising, though we do not see that, at least in the streets.
We do not see that, but they see an opportunity to turn it into that. Now, I think that's a miscalculation of the Egyptian population, but we simply don't know. And I think that you're seeing a president of the United States who is torn between, I think, a genuine affection for this kind of uprising. This is, after all, a man who grew up some in Indonesia, a country that went through another one of these after Suharto, and
made its way to much better democracy than it had.
A much better democracy and significant economic growth. Mm-hmm. And South Korea has been, you know, the poster child of economic growth, right? But on the other hand, recognizes that this is the country in which we have invested a huge amount of American interests, not only in maintaining the peace with Israel, but also our Iran policy as well, something you discussed yesterday. And there's going to be a very delicate balancing act here between bringing in democracy and holding on to an Egyptian government whose interests remain fairly well aligned with the U.S.'s.
Tom, do you have the sense that the Obama administration thinks it's riding this tiger fairly well? We heard testimony in Congress this week that the intelligence services here had not given any heads up about what was coming. Does Washington feel like it's, you know, got the right bead on this?
I think this is a really a critical moment, a critical decision moment for this administration, because for many decades, the United States has not wanted to take that risk of democracy in this region. The interests at stake are too much. On the other hand, there is potentially a payoff that a peaceful, if Israel can make peace with democratic Arab states, that would be seen to be a much more enduring and stable peace than one with authoritarian states.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, snowpocalypse again, but on Groundhog Day in Pennsylvania, Punxsutawney Phil came out to signal an early end to winter.
He surveyed his surroundings carefully and found that there was no shadow around. So an early spring it will be!
We'll take that. Super Bowl 45, Pittsburgh Steelers versus the Green Bay Packers this Sunday. But after this season, there's talk of an NFL player lockout. Here's Steelers defensive end Bert Kizell.
I need a job. I need my insurance. I got kids. I love doing what I do. I feel like I can still do it. And if they lock us out and don't let me play, I'm going to have to get in a backhoe somewhere and dig ditches or something.
And it's the year of the rabbit. Chinese Lunar New Year celebrations were big in Beijing. We're looking at a week in the news. Egypt, snow, and a Fed chairman's warning not to play around with the U.S. debt limit. David Sanger is with us, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Tom Jelton, correspondent for NPR, covers global security, economic issues. Our own Jack Beatty is here. A lot of people still can't pull their eyes off Egypt. Omaha, Nebraska. Stuart, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I'd just like to point out that anyone, including your guests who are complaining about the fact that we don't have much influence there, then that we can't risk a democracy. The U.S. has no one to blame but themselves. I mean, for heaven's sakes, for 30 years they've had a captive audience here. They could have built all kinds of ties to opposition groups and cultural exchanges, academia, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you had a guest on yesterday, Nicholas Burns, who, quite frankly, Tom, is part of the problem. He was involved in Greece, in which the infamous colonels ruled for quite a long time in a very repressive manner. And last comment, you just said, Tom, quote, that there was a much better democracy after Sukarno. This is ridiculous. Suharto murdered 500,000 people. He was a horrible dictator.
Look at Indonesia today is my point there, Stuart. Look at Indonesia today compared to what it has been through. But let us pick up your point. Nick Burns, of course, worked at very high levels for the U.S. State Department for a long time. He did the work of the United States government in many countries. That, of course, is sometimes controversial. You may not like it, but here's this idea again. Don't try to split the difference here. Go in and really support democracy. Is that not an option, or is it not clear, you know, that the United States, the great democracy, could do that?
You know, there's a great emotional temptation when you see the kind of incredible scenes we have seen in Cairo today, or really over the past
11 days,
to completely align the United States with this movement. And it's the trick between, as you said, whether you want to be out ahead of it or whether you want to be a little bit behind it. And there is a political risk in being behind it, but there may be a national interest risk in not leaping too fast. Nobody, I think, that I know of, including the guests you had yesterday, and I heard your show, has any reservations about moving Egypt to a true democracy. I think the reservation.
Really? Really? Nobody? I mean, because what I'm hearing described here is a kind of muffled democracy or a democracy with a bridle on it.
I think what you're hearing from your guests, I think what you are hearing is a democracy that moves in relatively small paces because, as we have seen in those examples that we described before, that this stuff never happens well instantly. Okay, and even Indonesia, and your caller was, I think, confusing the Sukarno period with Suharto, certainly a dictator. But when Suharto was gone, democracy did not spring up instantly. It came in a somewhat gradual fashion. Now, why is this? It's because when you have dictators like Mubarak who've been around, they have not allowed any political middle to develop. And they've not done that because it would be a threat to them. So if you're going to have a real democracy, you're going to have to give some time for people to begin to figure out political institutions and parties that are not just out at the extremes. And that takes time. Everybody would love to be able to flip a switch, But history tells us that doesn't always work.
Jack, we understand the many interests that may be tied up in that kind of approach, including the interests of many Egyptians for whom had a taste of chaos, maybe government-engineered chaos in the last week or so. On the other hand, if those demonstrators in Tahrir Square were sitting here at these microphones, and we've reached out a lot to Egypt, but if they were sitting here right now, I'm not sure what they would think of this. Easy does it, folks. You know, let's take it nice and slow here. That's not the message we've heard, at least from the square, Jack.
No, that's they feel the fierce urgency of now, and you know, stability is not you know, an end in itself. Lawrence Wright, someone quoted him this week, the author of the book on Al Qaeda, raising the question whether America's 9/11 wasn't born in the prisons of Egypt, wasn't born in the torturing of Mubarak, and in the, you know, in other words, just to have a stable government isn't really what matters so much as to have a legitimate government. Now, we have to be mindful of the tragic geometry of revolution. Starting with the Tsar, you wind up with Lenin. That has happened again and again, and sometimes because nations have tried to go too fast. But on the other hand, we have, it seems to me, a stake in a vibrant and moving process rather than into what we have had here, which is stultification, U.S. subsidized stultification. And I think it's a chance for the United States finally to get on, the cliche applies, the side of history here. And to say, yes, we have interest. We're willing to bet that a democratic regime, which will still be able to get U.S. aid, will continue the peace with Israel. Now, we heard from Steve Kinzer the other day that that's not consistent, that a truly democratic regime in Egypt wouldn't want to do that. That remains to be seen. That's a big risk.
Tom Gelton, talk to us about the politics back here in the United States. Very prominent Republicans have said, you know, we must speak with one voice on this. The president is doing not too badly here. But on the harder right, you know, we've seen other messages. Rush Limbaugh saying that the Obama administration, the U.S. seems to be sidling up to the Muslim Brotherhood. And you get really hard right. Here's, you know, talk radio on the right. Tammy Bruce says we have a president in up to his elbows in an Islamist takeover of Egypt. If he's found to have encouraged an Islamist takeover of Egypt, he should be impeached. What about the politics of all this at home, Tom?
Well, it's not as polarized a situation as we see around some other policy issues, including foreign policy issues, because some on the right, sort of, I guess you could loosely call them part of the neoconservative movement, believe that the United States should align itself with the forces of democracy in the world. And that includes a number of prominent Republicans as well. And you're right, there are others who say that the United States is in the process of embracing democracy, is coddling up to Islamists. So you don't see a unified opposition to the Obama administration's policy so far coming from the Republican side, or do you see sort of unified support from the Democratic side with respect to this? This is not an issue on which the parties break real cleanly.
Let's get a call from Bauman in Charlotte, North Carolina. Bauman, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm the Iranian which witnessed the Iranian Revolution in 1979. Jimmy Carter administration and Cyrus Vance asked the Shah for democracy and asked him to leave the country in favor of the democracy and for the demonstrators, which that led to the Islamic fundamentalists, which since then they've been executing so many Iranians and they've been abusing human rights. Is the United States going to repeat itself in 2011 now with the pressuring Mubarak to leave without having any establishment in place? Are they going to take another risk to allow the Islamist fundamentalists and Muslim Brotherhood, as you mentioned, today was a Friday prayer, and last Friday, which the mosque are mobilizing the crowd. That is a significant, and Iranian government in Tehran is helping them in many ways to let this fundamentalist to take over Egypt. Is the United States is ready to grab another Iran.
But, Bahman, let me ask you, you sound like a smart guy who's following closely here, plus you know the Iran experience. We're told repeatedly in the last few days that Egypt has got a different texture than Iran, that there's more of a sort of secular body of center of gravity here, that it's not so likely to slide that way, that the Muslim Brotherhood isn't even exactly cut that way anymore, though it may be, you know, a very significant. Is Egypt different? Maybe Egypt would end up in a different spot with democracy, not like Iran.
I travel to Egypt once a year. I do business in Egypt, and Egyptians are more fundamentally than Iran in 1979. In Iran, at that time, we didn't have any fundamentalists. There was a very small portion of the population was fundamentalist, which they hijacked the whole country. In Egypt, when you go to ride a taxi, there's a Quran in the dashboard. There are more Muslim. They go to Muslim prayers more than the Iranians. But there's a potential. I go to Egypt all the time. Egyptian people are very good people and they're very kind people. But there's a danger of letting the Egypt to go Islamist.
Bahman, I appreciate your call very much. We're going to do one more round on Egypt, and we've got a few other things to look at. But before I come back to you, David, Tom, Jack, let's hear these words from a familiar voice, Ronald Reagan. 100th birthday would have been this Sunday. People thinking about Reagan this week. Let's listen back to a little bit in this context. Listen back to his historic speech, June 12, 1987, Berlin, near the Brandenburg Gate. He noted that the Soviet Union, then still standing tall, was making some reforms in terms of allowing more freedom. But Reagan questioned whether all that was just window dressing.
Are they token gestures intended to raise false hopes in the West or to strengthen the Soviet system without changing it? We welcome change and openness, for we believe that freedom and security go together, that the advance of human liberty can only strengthen the cause of world peace.
Of course. If these were the words leading up to that famous climax, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. David Sanger, with that in our ears and Egypt in our eyes here on the television screen, and American interests and Egyptian interests all on the table, where do you think this ends? Where do you think this goes?
Well, you know, it's very tempting to do a direct comparison between the uprisings that led to the fall of the Berlin Wall and what we're seeing on TV now. And we have to remember that the historic context was quite different. We had been in complete opposition to the Soviet regime for many decades.
It was easy to say, tear down this wall.
And it was fairly easy to say that. In this case, as many of your callers have pointed out, we have been allied with a series of very authoritarian rulers, not just in Egypt, but in other places. So the interests are a little more complex. If you take the caller that we just heard before and you take the one that we heard just before him, you've gotten the polar opposite sides of this argument.
Yes.
Okay? So from the first one, you have a let's just leap in with the democracy protesters because they are our future. Let's get on the right side of history.
Mm-hmm.
And then from your Iranian caller or Iranian-American caller, you got a, hey, I was around once when we leapt in with the protesters and we weren't quite sure that we could control events thereafter. And I think that you are watching an Obama administration that is probably intellectually more aligned with your second caller, saying democracy is a great thing, but you want to make sure that you understand what's on the other side of the cliff. And, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood is a concern. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood has been around since 1920, and they have a 100% record of messing up almost every opportunity they've had to be a significant political force. So perhaps they don't need to be feared as much as, what happened in Iran.
Tom Gelton, control events. Is the United States controlling events here? Should it?
You know, Tom, I think the genius of Ronald Reagan was that he sensed that was his sense of timing. He sensed that the Berlin Wall, so to speak, was about to fall down on its own. So it was easy to say to Gorbachev, tear down this wall, because he knew it was going to fall down. And I think the timing is the issue here. Does this administration sense that the time to trust democracy in the Middle East may have come, that the reward for working depending on the on an alliance with corrupt authoritarian regimes may have outlived its usefulness, and that the time has come to begin to trust the democracy process. I think that's the judgment that has to be made, and it's analogous in that sense to the judgment that Reagan made, that a particular historical moment had arrived.
Jack, are we going to get a transparent view of the Obama mind and the outcome here and the U.S. posture here, or is this the whole foreign policy establishment going for some kind of middle path?
I think probably the latter. I think probably another Reagan quote, picking up on trust but verify. I mean, that's the issue now.
Hard to do in advance.
Hard to do in advance. But I think that we just have to believe that what comes next will be better. But the Iranian example, that circular tragic geometry of revolution, you just can't blink that away. And I think the president, to give him his due, has been has struck the right note. Even if he's representing a government that everybody on the ground in Egypt knows has not been on their side.
David Sanger, hard to look beyond Egypt this week. We've got half a minute to do it. Unemployment at 9%. Now, that's a significant drop. Is this an improvement, or is this just people dropping out of the workforce?
Well, this is, the unemployment rate going down to 9 is important politically and particularly important to President Obama, who I think recognizes that for re-election purposes, it's got to be down at 8
only
37.
36,000 jobs,
but there were only
created.
36,000 net new jobs. And what's interesting is that private employment rose faster than that, and that state government employment fell. And it's because you see all of these cutbacks in the states that are beginning to have a drag on the jobs picture.
So the jobs hard to grow, unemployment down. We've got a lot more to look at. Can barely get around Egypt here. Healthcare reform, politics in Washington, all that's no Super Bowl coming. But Egypt standing there as such a challenge to our understanding of where the world's going right now, that corner in particular. Really grateful to the three of you for being with us today. David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for The New York Times. Latest book is The Inheritance. David, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
Tom Gelton, Correspondent for NPR. It's always great to have you and your insights, Tom. Thank you for your thoughts today.
Always good to be with you, Tom.
Jack Beattie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.